Okay, everybody, let's talk now about the pathogenesis behind how SIBO occurs. So there's a couple reasons why understanding the pathogenesis is so important. One is it gives us additional information about when to test for SIBO. For example, we talked about some of the reasons of when to test for SIBO included various different disease processes such as IBS, rosacea, and autoimmune disease. In addition, if some of these types of pathogenic mechanisms are occurring, we should also be considering testing for SIBO. So we're going to talk, for example, about how protein pump inhibitors are a precursor for many people for development of SIBO. So if somebody has a strong history of protein pump inhibitor use, this is going to be another example of when it is a good idea to test for SIBO. In addition to that, we have found in our clinical practice, especially being cash-based, where people are really investing in our clinic because we are offering something different, that when we can explain the mechanism behind how they have their symptoms, it really does a lot for engaging and implementing trust with us that we can do something different for them. And that's really important with establishing that great relationship between provider and client. And we have really found that when we can take the time to explain the why behind disease to people, that people are much more interested in investing with us as a clinic, and they really appreciate the time that we take in actually having an understanding and helping them have an understanding behind why they feel the way they do. So some other pathogenic mechanisms that we need to talk about include gastric acid and protein pump inhibitors I just mentioned. Protein pump inhibitors oftentimes are prescribed for years for people when they've really only been approved for for a few weeks of use. So this long-term protein pump inhibitor will stimulate hypochlorhydria, which is low stomach acid. Low stomach acid has been linked in research to the development of SIBO. Motility disorders. So we've talked a little bit about abdominal scar tissue and surgeries. We mentioned cesarean section in a previous lesson. And the idea is the abdominal surgeries can cause disruptions to the migrating motor complex. The migrating motor complex, when that's disrupted, can cause SIBO. In addition, the emotional distress and the vagal nerve can play a role as well. Now, it's important to understand that the migrating motor complex and that process that we've previously described about the migrating motor complex and the development of SIBO is really not using the vagal nerve. So sometimes people will want to work on the migrating motor complex by doing vagal nerve activities. It's been proven in research that the migrating motor complex and the vagal nerve are not connected. The vagal nerve does regulate peristalsis and different parts of digestion. So it's absolutely important to consider the vagal nerve health when we're talking about SIBO. It's just that we need to differentiate and understand that it's a migrating motor complex working on the vagal nerve will not work. Now, emotional distress has been shown to dysregulate the vagal nerve function. So we know the vagal nerve works best when we're in a parasympathetic state. Emotional distress typically will raise cortisol, raise adrenaline, and put somebody into a sympathetic state, which can shut down and that vagal nerve function. So in subsequent modules in this course, we will talk a lot about how to work with emotional distress and how to really work with mindset to keep people calm even when they're going through their day-to-day basis. And part of what we're doing when we're teaching you this later on is how to work with the vagal nerve, which is going to impact all areas of health, and certainly SIBO is one of them. Chronic infections, so certain chronic infections have been shown to dysregulate and to cause inflammation of the vagal nerve, and multiple courses of antibiotics have been shown to affect the pathogenesis of SIBO as well. So if we're going to really look at the pathogenic mechanisms of SIBO, they can be broken down into five major categories. So the main categories of SIBO, the main categories of the pathogenesis and root cause of SIBO includes hypochlorhydria, motility issues, structural abnormalities of the GI tract, immune deficiencies, and alcohol or antibiotic overuse. Now, we've already really talked about hypochlorhydria, low stomach acid, and the use of protein pump inhibitors causing that. So there's not so too much more to say there, but let's go through the rest of them one by one. So talking about motility issues, so we've already mentioned that food poisoning will basically lead to that release of that virulence factor, that cytolithal distending toxin B. And because cytolithal distending toxin B will look similar to our immune system as the protein in the migrating motor complex known as vinculin, we start getting an autoimmune response against vinculin. So we have antibodies, autoantibodies that are created to the antigen of the cytolithal distending toxin B, and that CDTB antigen looks similar enough to the protein vinculin that we end up getting an autoimmune response against vinculin. That autoimmune response against vinculin is basically going to be a process that's going to be called, that's called in research, molecular mimicry. Molecular mimicry is simply a process where we have an antigen of something that is a problem in our body, and we have an immune response, an autoantibody response against that antigen. And the antigen looks similar enough to a protein in our body that our body, when it creates the autoantibodies against the antigen, it actually will start using those autoantibodies, will start also attacking the body protein. So that's a process that's been termed in research molecular mimicry. And we see that that's what's happening here when we have food poisoning, is we have a molecular mimicry autoimmune response against the vinculin protein of the migrating motor complex, and then the migrating motor complex shuts down, and that's how we get SIBO. Connective tissue disorders such as Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or scleroderma have also been shown to affect motility. So connective tissue, remember, is really holds the entirety of the body together. And connective tissue, of course, is seen in our gut. So if we have a situation where we have a connective tissue disorder and where our connective tissue is not functioning well, that has actually been shown to affect motility and lead to the pathogenesis of SIBO in some cases. Chronic infections such as Lyme, other vector-borne infections known as co-infections, viral infections such as EBV or CMV or herpes, these chronic viruses that basically can live dormant in our body, these types of infections have also been shown to affect motility. Some of these types of conditions, such as cirrhosis, portal hypertension, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, have also been shown to cause SIBO because of their effect on the biliary function. So when we have some of these liver inflammatory diseases and we are not able to create the amount of bile that we want to create in the liver, we can have a biliary and a bile depletion where we don't have the same level of bile that is secreted when we eat a fatty meal. This can lead to constipation in some, and others can get a lot of diarrhea and fatty stools. But the point here is that this biliary problem, this liver inflammation problem, this lack of bile that can be created can affect the motility and the fat breakdown, and that can lead to SIBO. Muscle function issues such as polyomyositis has also been shown. This is a very rare condition, but this can cause widespread muscle weakness. And this can lead to muscle weakness all over the body. And there's been some research that has linked this condition to SIBO as well due to that muscle weakness. Diabetes is another disorder, is another condition that has been shown to affect motility and has been shown to lead to the pathogenesis of SIBO. Now, what's also really interesting about diabetes is there's a condition called brittle diabetes, and brittle diabetes is where people have extremely hard time with diabetes regulating their blood sugar. So what happens with brittle diabetes and the brittle diabetes cases I've had is where people will regulate their blood sugar as far as they'll eat like the exact same meal every day, but the impact on their blood sugar can be dramatically different. Some brittle diabetes patients I've seen have had blood sugar drop all the way down to 30, and they have not had any symptoms of like passing out and only knew they were at 30 because of the regular testing. But it's very, very scary to see blood sugar go that low. So with this population, the question, of course, is why is it so difficult for them to regulate their blood sugar if they're eating the same thing every day and they're giving themselves the same bolus of insulin? SIBO is theorized to be one of the reasons for conditions like this where people are having a hard time with diabetes regulating their blood sugar despite eating well and proper monitoring. And the thought process behind it is that with SIBO, inflammation in the intestinal tract can vary from day to day, and that can actually create a change in the the quickness, the speed through which carbohydrates are absorbed from the intestinal lumen into the bloodstream. And so if somebody is more inflamed one day, they could eat the exact same meal, but the speed due to them being inflamed as far as absorption of the carbohydrates may be quite different than another day where they are eating the same meal and their intestines are less inflamed. So just an interesting thing to consider there. So here's a study that's really showing that the abnormalities in the migrating motor complex that we've already talked about can predispose to the development of SIBO. So we've already talked about the migrating motor complex and what it does. And the vinculin in the migrating motor complex, remember, vinculin is that protein that's within the migrating motor complex that's going to be attacked due to that autoantibody reaction from food poisoning and that release of the cytolethal distending toxin B. We also talked about that process of molecular mimicry. So here's just a little bit of research describing that cytolethal distending toxin V is a virulence factor. A virulence factor is a protein or another substance secreted by a microorganism that has the purpose of basically dysregulating our system in some way that's going to help that particular pathogen to survive in our human body. So we see that cytolethal distending toxin B is a virulence factor produced by various bacteria and that it can cause basically intestinal permeability by disrupting the tight junctions. The tight junctions are spaces that hold the cells together and are proteins that hold the cells together. And the problems with the tight junctions are linked to intestinal permeability, which we'll get to in later lessons, but that's a little prequel for you. So here's the process through which that cytolethal distending toxin B, through that molecular mimicry process, is attacking the vinculin. That's leading to the pathogenesis of IBS by affecting the gut motor function and leading to SIBO. So structural abnormalities can cause SIBO by affecting also the ability of some of these microorganisms to crawl into the small intestine, overgrow, and basically get trapped and stuck there. So structural abnormalities have been shown in research to be linked to SIBO include abdominal surgeries that leave scar tissue. So we already talked about abdominal surgeries in relationship to the migrating motor complex, but we also have the impact of abdominal surgeries causing scar tissue, and that scar tissue can basically create a problem with the gastrointestinal motility and therefore lead to SIBO through that mechanism. Crohn's disease due to the strictures will cause structural abnormalities. Celiac disease can cause structural changes to the small intestine. So any of these types of things can basically lead to SIBO by their dysfunction of the way that the gastrointestinal tract is functioning. The ileocecal valve is the valve that connects the small and large intestine. Now, what's interesting about the ileocecal valve is it can get inflamed and it can start dysfunctioning. We can sometimes see this even on imaging where the ileocecal valve can get stuck essentially in an open position. So you can probably imagine, since this is the valve that connects the large and the small intestine, that we can have a situation where the ileocecal valve is in a open position, and that open position is going to allow microorganisms from the large intestine to crawl into the small intestine and get stuck. Now, a in-office, non-invasive, non-expensive way of basically looking for ileocecal valve inflammation is to look for tenderness in the lower right quadrant where the ileocecal valve exists. So if you look in the lower right quadrant or feel palpate in that lower right quadrant of the abdomen and somebody feels mild tenderness, that can sometimes be ileocecal valve inflammation, which could lead to small intestinal bacteria overgrowth. And small intestinal diverticula, which affects about 1-6% of the population, is also a structural abnormality that can cause SIBO. So again, another time that you would consider testing for SIBO is if somebody has an abdominal surgery or they have a history of things like Crohn's, celiac disease, or if they've ever been told that there's a problem with their ileocecal valve. So here's just research that goes over all of that. Now, immune deficiency, and we should also say there is a level of immune dysregulation and not just deficiency that we see in relationship to SIBO. So we can have an abnormal antibody response, such as that vinculin antibody response, where we have the attack against the vinculin proteins of the migrating motor complex. Abnormal T cell responses in relationship to various disease processes has also been linked to and correlated with SIBO. And a secretory IgA elevation. Notice this one is elevation, which is why I'm saying that we have not only immune deficiency, but also just overall immune dysfunction and dysregulation. Secretory IgA is that first line defense of our intestinal tract and our mucous membranes against an invader. We talk about this a lot in the stool cultures testing section of this particular course. Now, secretory IgA is that first line defense. If I were to consume a parasite or a bacteria, what would happen is my secretory IgA levels would go up, and this would alert the rest of my immune system that there was an invader, a pathogen in the body, and would help to start the mounting of that immune response. So since the SIBO is linked to a food poisoning scenario, which would raise secretory IgA, this is probably through the mechanism through which we're actually seeing that IgA elevation is linked to SIBO. And here's just some research that goes over that. Our final section as far as pathogenesis of SIBO is alcohol and antibiotic overuse. And with alcohol, what we're seeing is a moderate consumption, even just 1 to 2 drinks per day, increases the risk for SIBO. And it increases about 20% over higher than control. So it's significant enough to basically consider that if somebody has SIBO, if they have a hard time getting over SIBO, we should really be asking about their alcohol consumption, because we're not talking about alcoholics here. We're talking about people that are really using alcohol, sometimes even moderately, just at a drink per day. And that really can increase that risk for SIBO. Antibiotic use, especially of multiple rounds in a row, can alter the flora within the gastrointestinal tract. So sometimes we'll see in our practice people for things like urinary tract infections or other pathogens, such as a staph or strep. These type of infections, we'll see frequently people prescribe round after round after round of antibiotics. We also see that a lot with Lyme disease. And with that, you know, with these particular prescribing mechanisms or these prescribing beliefs that we're seeing happen in conventional medicine, we really want to consider that this is a problem with some of those practices, is it can really set somebody up for SIBO. So another thing we can be asking people in our initial evaluation is just about their history with antibiotic use. And if their history is really high, certainly this is another time to consider SIBO. And here's just some research basically going over that, saying that 58% of people who consumed alcohol had a positive SIBO test. So it's pretty high compared to 38% of those who did not. So definitely showing a higher rate of SIBO. Again, this is a correlation study, but definitely interesting to consider. Okay, so the final thoughts in this particular lesson is really going to just remind us that and remind you that the reason for going through this is to help you understand SIBO so you can explain it better to your patients, as well as to understand additional times when you should be considering SIBO testing. We'll see you in the next lesson.